Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast for March 30th, 2017. I am your host, Adam Erickson, and I'm here with our guest, President of Theology and Peace, Sue Wright. Hi, Sue.
Hi. It's great to be here, Adam.
It's great to have you here today. How are you doing?
I'm well.
Awesome.
How are you? Spring is in the air. We have sunshine here today. That's like a big deal for us in central New York.
That is awesome. Yeah, I'm out here in Portland, Oregon, and it's going to rain for like the rest of my life. So that's just the way it goes. It's awesome. So you are the president of Theology and Peace. How long have you been the president of Theology and Peace?
Maybe 2 years. This will be my second conference as president. The conference coming up in May.
Nice.
So and I've enjoyed it. It's work, but it's like the best kind of work, I guess.
Awesome. I'm so glad. Well, I'm excited to talk with you about theology and peace and mimetic theory. But before we do that, I just want to let our audience know that if they have questions for Sue, you can write them in the chat room over there on the left-hand side. The Ravencast is part of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we write and talk about mimetic theory and the rivalry, violence, and scapegoating that often divides our communities. Our motto at the Raven Review is change your view, change the world. So if you like to hear new perspectives on religion, politics, pop culture, and current events, perspectives that seek to bridge divides and bring people together, then please subscribe to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. And I'm so excited today because we have Sue Wright on the Ravencast. Sue is, as I mentioned, the president of Theology and Peace. Sue earned her master's degree in theology at Bexley Hall Episcopal Seminary. And Sue is a frequent speaker at conferences throughout the world. Sue, you were recently in Australia giving a talk at a Colloquium on Violence and Religion conference, right?
Yes, I went to the cover conference there, and I have to say it was such an important conference. It left me with a real sense of the work ahead because it focused on the issue of religious extremism and how that impacts the way we relate to refugees, especially Muslim refugees.
Wow, yeah, that's incredibly important, especially in our current day and age, I guess. So, which is why they decided to have this conference on specifically that problem. Your paper was on the Gospel of John, right?
It was. It was looking at the Gospel of John, and it's something I've been studying for a long time, and especially the Bread of Life discourse, which some of you may already know, scholars have identified as a midrash. And one of the best examples of midrash we have from that time, and not only that, it's a midrash that seems to be very aware of our tendencies to scapegoat. So, can you see
that? Wow.
Yeah, so that's...
That's fantastic. If people want to get a hold of that paper, how can they get a hold of it?
It's not available yet, but they can contact me. And as soon as I have it in a form that I'm ready to release,
okay. I'll fantastic. It sounds amazing. So, but your work is inspired by mimetic theory. How did you first come across mimetic theory?
By accident,
you know,
I ordered a course at Syracuse University taught by a then graduate student who was writing his dissertation in religion. It was Tony Bartlett. Mm. And that dissertation turned into his first book, Cross Purposes, which some of you may have read. I recommend it. And I remember well the day that Tony told me about mimetic theory. I had joined him and his wife, Linda, on a trip to visit Gordon Cosby and Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. And in the road trip, the car trip down, I shared with them my disillusionment coming right out of heavy duty activist work. I shared with them my experience around the rivalry, which plagues the work that we do and how it undermines that work. And Tony, he told me about René Girard and mimetic theory, and I'd never heard about it before, but it was like one of those experiences, I guess, similar to the eunuch on the road to Emmaus, and he talks to Philip. I swear it was like that. But shortly after that, Tony introduced me to his doctoral advisor, which just happened to be Jim Williams. And Jim gave me some books by René Girard and Raman Schwager, including the Girard Reader. And we spent hours on the phone discussing those books as well as Dostoevsky. I was reading Brothers Karamazov at the time. And we discussed Thomas Merton. I was very lucky that I had received this intensive course in mimetic theory from one of René Girard's closest academic associates.
Yeah, that's would be a profound education right there. What was it about? What was it about? No, it's okay. Why? What was it about mimetic theory that kind of drew you to it? What is important to you about mimetic theory?
Well, I was the child of a single teenage mother who was on welfare, and she had 3 children by the time she was 20 years old. And that meant that my sisters and I grew up in difficult circumstances, and we experienced things that children should never have to experience. And I discovered at a young age a kind of terrible truth that when confronted with suffering or injustice, most people actually look the other way. I mean, there are always a few people who help, and I have to say those people make all the difference. But the truth is, and this is something that I study, and there's other mimetic theorists that do as well, that there are negative consequences to living in a free society where everyone is preoccupied with their own lives. And Paul Michel, for instance, is a very important political theorist working mimetic theory. And he explains that the moral distance, the space between us and our obligation to others, has become maximal, which means that, and this is in large part due to the fact that social networks that once induced people to care for those within their community have disappeared. And as Dumichel says, I'm going to quote him, we have no reciprocal obligation with respect to one another, except perhaps respect to family members and close friends. We are free with respect to one another. This is why we can be indifferent to the fate of others. So he points to the plight of the elderly, abandoned to nursing homes. And of course, we've all heard of the statistics about mass incarceration of Black men. And we know that poverty is once again on the rise. And we know that millions of people are displaced, refugees living out the worst kind of nightmare. And yet, because we're not obligated to do anything, no one is watching over our shoulder saying, hey, do something. Because we're so busy with our own lives, and as long as it has no direct impact on me, for the most part, we ignore it.
I'm reminded of God coming to Cain and saying, where is your brother? And Cain saying, am I my brother's keeper?
Exactly. And right. I recommend Dumichel's book, Barren Sacrifice, because he lays it out in such detail. I mean, how we've gotten to this place and what it implications for the role of tyranny. And so right now, I would consider it one of the most important books for our time. So to continue my story, why I'm attracted to mimetic theory. By the time I was 18 years old, you know, growing up in those circumstances, I was haunted by this image. And I used to think of it as an abyss at the core of American society. And I wondered at the time, how is it possible that the wealthiest nation on earth, a democratic nation, founded on the ideals of justice and freedom and equality, the things I was taught in school that I believed wholeheartedly in, how can the most vulnerable people in our society, children and teenage mothers like my mom, the elderly and the mentally ill, those people of color, how can they be allowed to fall through the cracks and kind of disappear into oblivion? And I have to say, as a teenager, I was already bitterly aware of the contradictions haunting our corporate American life. And it was a difficult time. But back in those days, you could still go to college on financial aid. That's what I did. So I went to state school and I majored in history and I took courses in political science and anthropology because I was looking for answers. I needed to reconcile this somehow. And unfortunately, I mean, you know, the more I learned about the sort of things they don't teach you in college, the more my existential crisis deepened. But I didn't give up. After college, I turned to activism, to building alternative economic communities grounded in social justice. I got very involved in the cooperative movement. And despite everything, I've never stopped believing in democracy. And I can say that at that time, and still, democracy is kind of a religion for me. Something that I hope inspires all of us.
And what is it like during this time you're coming into all of these stumbling blocks, right? Within democracy, what is it about democracy that kept you believing in it?
Because a democracy, it offers, I think, the best quality of life for the most people. It's right there, you know, in our founding documents. You know, it recognizes the rights of all people, and it recognizes that we all deserve to pursue our happiness, to have a good life. Mm-hmm. And I think in the core of my heart, I felt that that was the best promise, the best thing that I could think of.
So you mentioned that democracy was your religion and maybe still is your religion. What was your religion growing up like? What was your experience with religion?
My parents, they were children of the 60s, so they thought that they were liberated from religion, and words like theology were like bad words, and it was just all superstitious thinking. So the best that they would do is admit that Jesus was a good man, but other than that, they didn't have any use for Jesus or Christianity or really any form of religion. So I grew up in a secular household. But when I was 20 years old, I mean, I was on this search, you know, and I was reading a lot of political science. I didn't know where to look. It seemed like the best place, but accidentally I picked up a Bible one day and I read John's Gospel, which to this day is still, I think, my favorite gospel. And I can't tell you the impact it had on me.
What was it about the Gospel of John that impacted you?
For the first time, I encountered a concern for the weak, the poor, the outcasts, something I had rarely experienced in my day-to-day reality. It was the very thing that I wanted society to be, that I thought it should be, and there it was in the Bible, something my parents had told me was just a lot of superstition. So from there on, I think I didn't become a Christian right away, but I started to look in that direction. And I guess I'll say it wasn't until my encounter with mimetic theory that I actually joined the church, became a member of the Episcopal Church, and went to seminary, and today, it's, you know, maybe, I guess 20 years later, theology and mimetic theory form a really important part of my life's work, so.
Yeah, it's kind of it made a big impact on you. It's kind of a game changer for you. What about mimetic theory is this game changer in your life?
It really was. I mean, I have to say that mimetic theory was the thing that brought me to Christianity, to studying the Bible, to even thinking about theology. I don't know that it would have happened otherwise. And I guess that's because it gave me a language to identify the why of what's wrong with American society, and it gave me a really practical methodology that cuts deep enough to address it, to formulate real answers. And that's something, you know, when you've come from kind of the place that I've come from, you want real answers.
Yeah. And you found those real answers in René Girard's books. René Girard is the founder of mimetic theory, the modern day founder of mimetic theory. You go through Deceit, Desire, and the Novel, which is his first major work. What was it about that book that impacted you?
I have to admit, it's one of the best reads I've ever had. It's such a great book. And I remember the first time I opened the book and read that, the title of its first chapter, Triangular Desire. It's so intriguing. Deceit, Desire in the Novel introduced me to the world of mimesis and something I was completely unfamiliar with, and that is the world of imitated desire. And Girard, a literary theorist, realized that the great novelists intuited that they, like the characters in their novels, were trapped within desire's mimetic web. They experienced a kind of conversion, a point in the writing when they could no longer heroize the myth of spontaneous desire. And the spontaneous desire is that idea that we as autonomous individuals can desire whatever it is our eyes land on, you know, and that it's something unique to me, my own desire. And Girard says that these novelists reveal in their works that all desires are borrowed. We do not choose for ourselves the objects of our fascination. We desire those objects because they are first desired by another. So that was a groundbreaking revelation. And from there, he goes on to describe, using all these great novels, the mimetic intrigues and passions which take hold of all our lives, the kind of unconscious dynamics that we're all subject to, but maybe never really understood. So that includes love triangles and all the disastrous rivalries that we've engaged in, the hidden resentments we harbor, and the moments, and this is the best part, the moments of transcendence, when we are with some kind of grace, we're able to rise above it.
Mm. This is often a scandal to modern people to think that we are not autonomous creatures, that our desires are shared by others. So people often react to this as in defiance. No, my desires are mine, and I own them. And how do we manage that scandal, do you think? How do we get beyond that? What was it about you that was like, oh yeah, this makes sense. This explains things to me.
I guess it was personal experience. I had gotten to a place in my life where some of the truths that Girard's insights kind of leapt off the page because I had experienced, say, in my community activist work, working closely with small groups of people, that whenever two or three are gathered together, mimetic desire presents a significant challenge to our peaceful coexistence, to our ability to actually get along and accomplish maybe some positive things that we all would like to see. And that's because imitated. Oh, go ahead, Adam.
No, I was just going to say, wherever two or three are gathered, there is this potential for conflict and rivalry. And Jesus, I think in the Gospel of John, says wherever two or three are gathered, I am there, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So
how do we make sense? How does mimetic theory help us make sense of those two dichotomous views, I guess?
Well, when we understand that imitated desire leads to competition over objects, and competition over objects erupts into a contagion of rivalry and reciprocal violence, we're able to make those connections in our own lives. And it applies to really any situation in our jobs, in our church communities. And I would have to say that I would hope that everyone would read that book, because it acts in my mind as a kind of manual for understanding our human interactions. And in understanding them, we can start to seek a different way of being together. And that's the key. Because until we understand them, we're kind of, we're trapped by them. We're bound with them. And we don't really understand what is coming at us from day to day, and why we are reacting the way we are. And sometimes we want to react differently, but we don't even know how.
Yeah, that's great. So you read Deceit, Desire in the novel, and the next book that Gerard writes is Violence and the Sacred. What role did Violence and the Sacred have for you?
For me, that's where Gerard starts to reach into the political sphere. I mean, he's looking at archaic cultures, but he actually develops an incredibly useful hypothesis on the origins of human culture. And I say hypothesis, that's the word he uses, because we'll never really know what happened. But what he describes is a prehistoric scene when our ancestors, in a fit of violent mimesis, and I, you know, just entertain this for a while, because you might find this useful too. When they channeled all that reciprocal aggression that's generated by desire crisscrossing communities, they channeled it, all that violence that's threatening to engulf the community, they channel it onto a single individual, someone who is, you know, expendable. And what then becomes a mimetic conversion of all onto a single individual, that provides cathartic release. And the community is delivered from what would have been the disastrous effects of their own violence in what feels to them like a miraculous moment. They think they've been saved, in a sense.
But there's a catch, right? Like, the community can't admit that it has scapegoated someone.
No. In a sense, they have to lie to themselves, because to admit that would deprive them of the peace of just that they've just miraculously received. And in prehistoric communities, they reenact that original moment in sacrificial rituals, and they repackage it in mythological stories in which the gods, not the human beings, demand the sacrifice. So they excuse themselves from any responsibility. And today we do something very similar. We dehumanize the scapegoat, and we rationalize their treatment as necessary to our own safety. So
yeah, you saw this a lot in your work, your justice work, right?
Oh yeah, you become very aware of it, that how entrenched it is within our society. And without mimetic theory, it was very hard for me back then to think about ways to address it. You don't have the language or the conceptual framework to really understand what's going on. You know it's wrong. Why is this happening? I mean, intellectually, there's no reason to scapegoat Black people. There's no reason to scapegoat someone because they're elderly or mentally ill. But nevertheless, you notice that there's kind of this, something takes over the collective consciousness, and all of a sudden people, the entire community, is engaged in this behavior, and it's hard to stop it once it gets going.
Yeah, this for Girard is the birth of the violent sacred that is that he claims is the foundation of all human culture. This is how deeply rooted the scapegoat mechanism is in every human culture, right?
When we read ancient texts, whether they're Greek or Hebrew or Egyptian, when we look at the archaeological records, it becomes really clear that the fear of violent contagion, the fear that the violence, the reciprocal violence resulting from mimesis, imitated desire, that it will get out of control and overwhelm our communities, that leads archaic societies to contain mimesis and its effects through prohibition and ritual. That's what Girard says. And that is the strict rules regulating desire paired with rituals to redirect violence onto a sacrificial victim. And mimetic theory clarifies why, with the advent of the modern nation state, and this is the part, this is what becomes really powerful in my mind, why citizens, and this comes also out of Paul Dumichel's work, why they willingly relinquish power, most notably the right to seek retribution. It's that same fear of violent contagion. By recognizing the state as the only legitimate force, who will punish you if you, out of some kind of envy, kill your neighbor or try to steal your neighbor's stuff, the state will punish you. And the effect of that is it has a really powerful effect in that it liberates us to pursue our desires without fear of violent contagion. I mean, this is revolutionary. This is probably the first time on earth that a society has had that kind of freedom. And in a democratic society like ours, this not only leaves us free to pursue our desires, it unleashes consumerism on a massive scale. So we get to imitate each other, not only without fear of conflict, but we can go out and do it on a daily basis at the mall, online, on Amazon.com. We're doing it all the time. It sounds great, huh? Fun. But there is a dark side to this, and we can't ever forget it, that even a democratic society like ours is founded upon systemic scapegoating. And that we continue to ch achieve peace, and we continue by redirecting all our internal tensions. And it's really important to think about that in the present. We continue to redirect it on scapegoats.
Yeah, the next book that Girard wrote is Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, right? And I see you smiling as I talk about this book. It was impactful for me too. What was it about this book that helped you?
Well, Things Hidden is Girard's reading of the Hebrew and Jewish scriptures, in which he discovers that these texts are shaped by an awareness of mimesis, of imitated desire, and of rivalry. And the various authors of the Hebrew texts understood, in one certain sense or another, the threat of violent contagion. And they understood our proclivity to scapegoating. And out of their own context, this is really important, this is unique, the Hebrew writers developed a sensitivity to the plight of the victim. And it's almost inexplicable, but nevertheless, it's out of that experience that the Hebrew and Christian texts start to read with start to read their start to read that they can be read within that struggle, within a struggle to get free of our reliance on scapegoating. Now, that for me, that was maybe the moment of most significant revelation in reading Girard. I mean, everything else up to that point was was just like one light bulb going off after another. When I read that, it really matched something within my own experience growing up, and it answered what I would say was a deep longing in my own heart. It was the very thing that I needed to encounter.
Yeah, another very profound statement that he has comes from his book, I See Satan Fall Like Lightning. And he says that the Hebrew authors are the first people in history who really have this concern for the victims. Like every other culture in human history kind of sees victims as it's their own fault, or it's the will of the gods, or something like this. But the modern concern for victims really stems from the Hebrew scriptures.
Yeah, it's true. And whether you're looking at the prophetic texts, or you're looking at the histories, or the wisdom texts, there it is. And it's who can say why it happened the way it did, but thank God it did, because it's out of that experience I say that so much of Western civilization, the best parts of Western civilization have developed.
Yeah, another thing that's helpful that Gerard has said for me is to see the Bible as a text in travail. So you'll have a lot of maybe atheists say, oh yeah, what you say is nice, but then God demands that, you know, these genocide against these certain people as they come in. And Gerard says that the Bible is a text in travail. It's a text that's struggling with itself to come up with these this concern for the victims, right? The concern for the scapegoats. So you have both kind of revelation and what Gerard would call archaic religion kind of struggling within the biblical text.
Well, that's the kind of text we need, because it's always a struggle. And there are multiple voices engaged in it, in the struggle. And when we see what they're saying to each other back and forth, those voices in dialogue with each other, that's what it is, a dialogue. We learn something and we can build upon that. And isn't it better to view the Bible that way, that this, it's not just something that God beamed down and put on a plate for us to read, but that it's far better that it is about this struggle to overcome, a very human struggle to overcome what is a very tempting response to our own mimesis, and that is scapegoating. Until we learn some other way, we will continue to revert to scapegoating. And so it's scapegoating has it's a seductive side, and I'm not saying that it's good in any form, but because it keeps this false peace, you see. But the fact is when we see that there's this struggle underway, and that people are able to rise above it, then we can follow in those footsteps, and we can continue that work.
I love it. That's a great way to think about it. Let's talk about Theology and Peace. You are the president of this organization. You have been for about 2 years. What is the mission of Theology and Peace?
Theology and Peace was formed 10 years ago by Tony Bartlett. Some of you may know him. At that time, he was a professor of theology at Bexley Hall in Rochester. And Michael Harden, the director of Preaching Peace, and Tom Nickel, an Episcopal priest in Larchmont, New York. And it just so happens that this year's conference will be celebrating our 10th anniversary.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, exciting. At that time, they and others recognized the need for a forum where those of us who wanted to unapologetically consider the implications of mimetic theory for Christian theology and praxis could gather and openly discuss these things. COVR, which is a great organization, the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, is an academic organization, and that was founded over 25 years ago, and it invites scholars from diverse disciplines to discuss the continued application of mimetic theory as it regards their various fields. But a number of us on the board are members of COVER. Theology and Peace invites pastors, we invite lay people, theologians, activists, anyone who wants to explore what many of us have discovered, and that is mimetic theory provides a much needed source for the renewal of Christian discourse and its engagement in the world. So what we do is we host an annual conference, and this year it will be held May 22nd to the 25th in Chicago at Techne Towers, and you can go to our website and get more information on that. And we also host ongoing forums on our website and on our Facebook page. So that's where we started, but I want to tell you some more about us, because that kind of sounds bland, you know, like, oh, there's a canned speech, you know. That I want to tell you how we've evolved over the course of 10 years, how our engagement with mimetic theory has changed us and has drawn us into places we might not have gone otherwise. Like Jesus, we have found ourselves in the place of crisis, partly because we tend to host our conferences in cities where the violence is front page news. We've been to Baltimore in 2015 and 16. We went to Raleigh, North Carolina, just as the Moral Monday protests were getting underway, and we met with those folks nightly to pray with them and discuss with them what they were going through. And this will be our third year in Chicago. And looking back, I can say that in 2011, Theology and Peace made a really significant decision, and who couldn't have seen this when we started, but it's what I've been terming our turn to racism. And that year we chose to go to Baltimore, and board members Tony Ciccarello and Tony Bartlett saw out personal connections in Sandtown community in Baltimore. And that's a neighborhood which, if you recall, a few years ago erupted in protest after the death of Freddie Gray, a member of the Sandtown community who died while held in police custody. It was there that Tony C and Tony B encountered newborn ministry, and Elder C.W. Harris and Wendell Holmes, leaders of that community and good friends of ours. Since then, members of Sandtown community have become important contributors to the work of Theology and Peace, and I think such a necessary component. And then again in 2013, when we were planning our sixth annual conference, and I remember this, I wasn't on the board, but I remember these conversations, the board decided, made a decision that has had really a very profound impact on our mission since then. And that was, despite some hesitation and a bit of trepidation, they chose a conference title with the word lynching in it. And the title then was Lynching, Scapegoating, and Actual Innocence. And there were concerns that that was too strong and we were going to offend people or scare them away. Well, guess what? Last year was the fourth year we addressed the problem of racism. It's not a topic that you can just address in one conference. It's not going to go away anytime soon. We're not finished. But I can say that having shared conversations with Black theologians and community activists and people on the inside of the justice system, because we invite them to, we've gained what I would say a real tangible sense that we can change what Ann Kruger, one of our presenters from past year's terms, our collective intentionality, not just in our church congregations or in our activist communities, but at the very heart of the sacrificial system. Say, for instance, at the very heart of our justice system. I mean, that's the kind of work that I think I can speak for the entire board. We consider ourselves engaged with. That's what needs to happen. And so that means going to ground zero, so to speak, and having encounters. Last year, we tried to bring together both people and police, those who are at the heart of the crisis there in American cities, where intentionality between where intentionality has been left to chance, and police and people are ill-equipped to respond to each other in heated moments of conflict.
We hear so much bad news about this. It seems like every time we hear something about it, it's bad. What gives you hope that things are getting better, that things can get better?
I guess because I feel we have, because I see what happens when people come together, when I've met people who have encountered mimetic theory, people like Preston Shipp, who is now on our board. He was an appellate court prosecutor. He was one of the people working for the war on drugs, in a sense, sending people to prison, who were appealing, trying to get out of prison, because it really is an unfair system. He was one of the people keeping them there. And now he's on our board. And I've had conversations with people like Neil Franklin, who was, again, one of those people on the forefront of the war on drugs in Baltimore. And he has had a total change of heart. And now he dedicates his life to trying to not only bring an end to the war on drugs, but to re-educate police and city administrations in what it takes to bring people together, police and communities, to create a peaceful environment where everyone can live a good life. So I guess mimetic theory is such a powerful diagnostic tool that when you put it to work, it gives you the language to deconstruct the sacrificial systems that all of us feel so powerless to stop. But nevertheless, when you have that language and when you become aware of your own behavior within that system, you can start to change it.
It's very powerful because racism feels like this just big giant thing that's impossible to stop. It's part of the foundation of the sacrificial system, as you say, that is the United States. And it's obviously still infecting us today. And I often hear people say, take this personally when we talk about racism. So white people say, oh, I'm not a racist. But it's kind of, or I hate racism, but it's so deeply entrenched in the American structure. How do you talk about racism in a way that kind of opens people up, I guess, to seeing the power structures that run throughout our American system?
Well, first off, I'm one of those people who says I'm not racist, mm-hmm. but I know that that's part of the collective lie we tell ourselves that actually helps sustain that system. What mimetic theory does is it consistently challenges the status quo, especially that assumption that scapegoating is too entrenched. It helps us identify the ways in which this nation is founded upon the scapegoating of Black people or Indigenous peoples. We can recognize, I guess it gives us the tools that in the moment when it's happening, we can recognize the stereotypes being deployed against Black men, perpetuated by the media as a means in which our political leadership utilizes to designate an entire population as scapegoats. So we can choose not to participate in it, and we can also be the voice that said that counters those allegations, the accuser when it's mobilized. But more importantly, we don't have to accept those labels at all. We can understand that we are all, in a sense, victims within a violent mimetic system, and we can come together. Wherever we are, we can be the person who's been incarcerated for 20 years because of some silly drug possession charge. We can be the person who put that him there, someone like Preston. We can be the police officer who had to bust down his door to arrest him. We can be me, who doesn't always know how I'm supposed to respond. And we can gather around the table and we can start to talk honestly about our participation in that system and how we're going to change it.
That's awesome. Let's start talking about this year's conference. What is the theme of the conference this year?
It's embracing we-centricity and practices that nurture the common good. And I believe the neuroscientist Vittorio Galese, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Sounds good to me.
He's an important neuroscientist. He coined the term we-centricity to describe our inherent openness to the other. See, this is the thing. Mimetic theory is good news and bad news. Well, it's bad news and good news because we're all connected. And from the day of birth, our neurons are building pathways, and we rely on the stimulation from others to develop things like empathy, to develop our emotional responses to others. And so that means that whether we like it or not, we cannot escape the fact that we are all interconnected. And that can be for good when we lack self-awareness and the unconscious dynamics that lead us to scapegoating go unchallenged, or it can lead us to the best possible good when we recognize that interconnectedness and we start to utilize it to build, to actually rewire our brains through the kind of practices that we're going to be exploring at this conference. Something that Vittorio Galese says is that we're actually wired for mimesis. And as I said, from the moment of birth, that means that we're not autonomous individuals, that we are going to have to work together to find solutions. And I often think that our title, Theology and Peace, and in this case, you know, embracing we-centricity, practices that nurture the common good, it sounds a little naive, but it isn't. And it's really key to understanding the nature of our work. Because of interconnectivity, like I said, and the unconscious dynamics that lead us to scapegoating, it's important that we recognize that things like peace and theology, as long as we lack the self-understanding to disengage from scapegoating, those will lead us to seek peace founded on the scapegoating of a victim. And on the other hand, when we use mimetic theory as a tool for self-understanding, we can begin to talk about peace, to try to practice a peace between us, a way of coexisting that doesn't involve scapegoating, or at least struggles to free ourselves from scapegoating, because it's always a struggle. There's no quick fix.
Yeah. Tell us about the speakers who are going to be at the conference.
All of our speakers will engage us in practices, essentially, like, and I borrow this from, I think it's from Cynthia Bergeau, she's a teacher of contemplative practice. She says, neurons that fire together, wire together. I don't know if she got that saying from someone else, but I really like it. And so this is just my understanding is that all of these practices in essence if we really take them seriously and we practice them over time, we'll rewire our brains. So when we think, if it's true that we're wired to be mimetic, then engaging these kind of practices together and reflecting back, you know, constantly, imitating each other all the time, that we could rewire ourselves to become not habitual scapegoaters, but habitual peacemakers free of scapegoating. So in any case, our first session will be led by our board member, Sarita Richardson, and she will present on circle processes. And Sarita is a young Black woman. She is a single mother and an ex-police officer from Mississippi, and she is one of the most eloquent spokespeople for mimetic theory that I have yet to meet. And I guess her eloquence is born, I think, out of life experience. And though she's our youngest member on the board, she is probably our wisest. And she will set the stage for this year's conference by leading us in circle process. And circle process, if you're not familiar with it, there's a very good book out there by Kay Prannis, The Little Book of Circle Processes. It uses the imagery borrowed from the experience of Native Americans. And it's good, it's really powerful, good imagery. Ancestors gathered around a fire in a circle, and even families gathered around a kitchen table. And that gathering in circles of communities, we can start to solve problems. I mean, that's the perfect format in which to apply mimetic theory and try to build communities of peace free of scapegoating. And then we are very happy to welcome back Brian Robinette. He is professor of theology from Boston College. And in my mind, he's one of the most important thinkers in mimetic theory, who has thought and written extensively about the Christian contemplative tradition in light of mimetic theory. And I've heard him talk a number of times, and he always wows me. He says things like this, I'll share it. When we turn our gaze inward, we can learn to recognize all the forms of desire within us. That is key. And he says, the contemplative life is not opposed to the active life. It is freedom from the reactive life. And by cultivating stillness, we let go of our neighbor as our mimetic hook. This for me is the cutting edge where mimetic theory needs to go when we are trying to apply it theologically to Christian practice. If we in stillness can free ourselves, we can just step back enough, observe ourselves and how we're reacting every moment, the constant stimulation that's out there day to day, hooking us all the time. Mm-hmm. If we can step back from that, we're moving in the right direction. And then also we have Martin Laird, who is a professor of theology at Villanova, and he and Martin will present together. They're very good friends. And Martin has extensive training in contemplative tradition. He gives retreats both in the U.S. and the United Kingdom. But I have to say, he is one of my favorite writers on contemplative tradition. And when I need to give someone a book about contemplative tradition, I give them one of Martin Laird's books. I've done that for years. And he, I think, is one of the best writers on how contemplative praxis, how Christian contemplative practice actually frees us from the endless mill of suffering in our own thoughts and anxieties. He's very good. Then we have Jonathan Brenneman. He is from the Mennonite Church. He is the coordinator of the Israel-Palestine Partners in Peacemaking. And Jonathan comes from a long line of Mennonites on his father's side and from a prominent Palestinian Christian family on his mother's side. And he grew up in a small town in Ohio. And after attending university and studying history and philosophy, he went to work as a Christian peacemaker in Palestine, in Hebron. And he was part of the mission to build partnerships to transform violence and oppression there. And he worked on the ground with Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers and organized in the U.S. to challenge oppressive Israeli practices. So he's one of the people who is always bringing what can be a very charged situation. He's bringing those people to the table and trying to find, you know, in a circle, so to speak, trying to seek solutions. So he's worked in, was trained in Cape Town, South Africa, by organization there that advocates for land policies. And he went to Notre Dame at the Kroc Institute, where he was also trained in peacemaking. So it's a great lineup. And we have other presenters too, and all of them will be focused on practices. So what I like to think about is when we take, say, Girard's book, Deceit, Desire in the Novel, which really gives us a very detailed account of all the ways we work mimetically, all the hooks, you know, from every kind of possible angle. It's a great read, better than any soap opera. And you pair that, say, with the kind of practices that we're going to engage with at this conference. I myself, and I know the board members of Theology and Peace share this. We can start to think of tangible ways that we can become self-aware enough to observe mimesis, not only within ourselves, but as a group, and to intentionally start to transform our responses on a day-to-day basis so that we can disengage from scapegoating when it gets mobilized, as it is, I have to say, in our present situation. We can step back from that, recognize what's happening, even recognize the way we might be hooked into it and tempted to you know, join forces, to join the fray. We can step back from that and actually have, I think, who is it? Family systems theory, that kind of non-anxious presence in the midst of the storm. We can become the witness for another way of being, an alternative. And I think when people have an alternative, one that might actually provide a true lasting peace, they may actually, they'll be drawn to it enough to start to want to understand it.
It's so important to me, because a lot of times when people hear, step away from all of this scapegoating that's going on, look within yourself, a lot of times people hear that as, don't worry about the injustice that's going on in the world. Don't try to fight it, because you're just going to end up scapegoating someone. But Theology and Peace believes that you can't have peace without also seeking justice. There's this connection that's happening in there. And talk a little bit about justice and the work that Theology and Peace does.
Well, Girard doesn't necessarily speak directly about justice, but it's there in his thinking. And peace, what we need to understand is that words like peace and justice, they're so easy to utilize, and they often come at the expense of the weak, or a peace or justice is achieved through scapegoating someone. And powerful nations will sign all sorts of peace treaties and call it justice and mercy. But as long as one person is left out of that equation, as long as any one group is scapegoated, say, to bring that peace about, to create that justice, then it's not lasting. Because as Girard explains to us, those systemic systems grounded in scapegoating will always kind of self-combust. And the violence will eventually turn back on us. And so I think of Zechariah chapter 7, verse 10. I'll read it to you. Thus says the Lord of hosts, render true judgments, show kindness and mercy each to his brother. Do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the sojourner, or the poor, and none of you devise evil against his brother in your heart. And then the response, but they refused to hearken and turned a stubborn shoulder and stopped their ears that they might not hear. So it's not that there is an inherent threat out there, do this or else, God's demanding justice, but the fact is there is no justice until the weakest member of our societies are cared for, are able to have a life free of hunger and poverty. When we welcome the stranger and when we clothe the widow and the orphan, until we start to care for all members of our society, none of us are safe. None of us will ever experience any sort of lasting peace.
That helps me understand the theme of the conference, We Centricity, even better. So thank you, Sue, for for your work with Theology and Peace and for all that you do. It does sound like a great lineup, and thank you for helping to put it all together with the other board members of Theology and Peace. If people want to come to the conference, it's in Chicago, May 22nd through the 25th.
Yes, at Techne Towers, and you can go to our website, theologyandpeace.org, or you can also get to it through Theology and Peace on WordPress. And there's a link there to registration, and all the conference details are there. We hope you awesome. Come. Awesome.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Sue, for being with us today and talking through all of these really important issues with us. It's been enlightening and always a great time to talk with you. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Adam.
If you want to stay up to date on the Ravencast, you can join the Ravencast group page on Facebook. You can also like the Raven Foundation Facebook page. If you are watching this recording on YouTube, please help us get the word out by liking the video and sharing it with your friends or your enemies. Why not? That's fun. And if you are listening to it on iTunes or Stitcher, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Next Thursday at 12 o'clock Central, we're going to be talking with Marty Reneke, a professor at Northern Iowa University, about outrage and Donald Trump and also disgust psychology. So that should be a lot of fun. So join us next week, Thursday at 12 o'clock Central. We will get out the ways that you can join that live show on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. So go over and check it out. Last thing, go over and check out the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org and subscribe to the Raven Review. That'll keep you up to date on articles and interviews like this one. So until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.